We are particularly pleased to be joined this evening by Dr. Leonard Peikoff. Tonight, Dr. Peikoff will address the timely subject of crime. He says most crimes are committed by hardened career criminals who start their sprees very young. He will discuss the essence of the criminal mind and the proper nature of rehabilitation. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Leonard Peikoff.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A great deal of time and money has been devoted over the years to the issue of the cause of crime. Social and physical scientists, the acknowledged experts in this field, ignore philosophy, who doesn't today, and look instead for empirical correlations out of context. The result is an undigestible, seemingly endless list of causes, all of which have their ardent defenders. Crime, we hear, is caused by racial discrimination, broken homes, the decline of religion, TV violence, genes, drugs, unemployment, mental illness, capitalist greed, poverty, street gangs exerting peer pressure, too little serotonin in boys' brains, too many handguns, a low resting heart rate, urbanization, industrialization, immigration, or too much testosterone in the male system. And that's just a sample of today's chaotic theory. As to the success of these experts' ideas in practice in reducing crime, you need merely look at the crime rates, the escalation of random violence, the rising national panic, and increasingly the empty streets of our cities at night, with the homes of the free and the brave, and it seems soon our public office buildings too, barricaded behind expensive security systems. Perhaps, after all, you need to understand something about values and human nature in order to understand and cope with crime. Perhaps philosophy does have something to say about crime. Is it possible that crime is a philosophical issue and can only be understood and stopped by philosophical means? That is my viewpoint, which I am going to outline to you this evening. Now, crime in a broad sense is any act prohibited and punished by a government. As such, the term may include acts which are legitimate morally, like having an abortion, for instance, or betting on the horse races. So I'm going to confine myself tonight to the crimes that really matter to people. Serious crimes of aggression condemned around the world. Acts which involve the initiation of physical force against the person or property of innocent persons. Crimes such as rape, assault, robbery, theft, murder. Now, most of these crimes, about three quarters of them is the most likely estimate, are committed not by occasional offenders or by solid citizens who go berserk, but by a very small minority of people, a group of hardened career criminals who have long records of arrest. Here's one quote. One study tracked 10,000 males born in Philadelphia in 1945 for 27 years. It found that just 6% of them committed 71% of the homicides, 73% of the rapes, and 69% of the aggravated assaults attributed to the group, unquote. Some criminals commit hundreds or thousands of crimes in their lifetimes. The average seems to range from 10 to 20 major felonies for each career criminal. These hardened criminals include 10 times more males than females, and they commit most of their worst crimes in their teens and 20s. Their behavior pattern, however, almost always stretches back to their early childhood. Quote, almost all chronic adult offenders were also juvenile offenders, observes one authority. And he goes on, over 50% of the criminal males in one study showed an onset of symptoms prior to the age of 8. Unquote. Another writer who studied several hundred adult criminals intensively declares that, quote, it became evident that as early as the age of 4, the criminal as a child was a different type of person. In most cases, his parents' way of life was totally different from his own, unquote. I got this idea of drinking from a bottle from Dennis Miller. I think it's a terrific idea. Judging in terms of their character, attitudes, likes and dislikes, these career criminals are surprisingly similar. It was surprising to me anyway when I started my research on this topic. After a certain amount of reading, I could not avoid coming to the conclusion that there is a criminal type, or a criminal mind, or a criminal personality, which in some form is common to these people. In my view, it is not an innate endowment, but a set of acquired traits. And these are the traits that must be understood if we are to get a handle on crime. The textbooks of the experts offer volumes of characteristics relevant to crime, which, however, the writers present as a mere observational hodgepodge and rarely interpret in terms of essentials. So let us now do their intellectual job for them. Of all the descriptions I have read, 5 broad attributes or traits of the criminal type leap out at me as its essence. 1, impulsiveness. By the very nature of crime, this one seems to be the most obvious, and it is universally remarked by commentators. The criminal has weak self-control. He wants something, he has to have it, he grabs it, whether it is a wallet or his victim's throat. What moves him is the immediate satisfaction of a desire, an urge, a wish. Most of us generally forego small, immediate satisfactions for the sake of much better things we can gain later. The criminal type does not like to defer the present for the future. He is highly short-range, or what is called, quote, present-oriented. Like the activists of the 1960s, he wants it now. Most of us think before we act. We think about the means of achieving our goals and about the consequences to come. The criminal type devotes little thought to means or consequences. Typically, he has poor judgment, sudden changes in plan, and an attack of temper if frustrated. Rarely does he learn from his experiences or change as a result. Animals and infants, likewise, are not moved by any long-range future goal. They are confined to the immediately perceived. They are, we say, perceptual-level creatures, because they either don't have at all or haven't yet developed the ability to think, to use concepts. The criminal can speak. He has developed a vocabulary of concepts, but his concepts do not significantly rule his life or govern his behavior. In regard to action, he remains like an animal or an infant. 2, these are my order, needless to say. Anti-intellectuality. Now, this trait is an obvious corollary of the first. The intellect is the conceptual faculty, the capacity to form and deal with abstractions and general principles, and thereby to grasp facts and laws of reality available to reason and logic, but not to simple sense experience. It is only through the intellect or the intelligence that we can transcend the desire and percept of the moment. Obviously, to the impulsive personality, such a faculty seems alien and unattractive. The criminal type is contemptuous of the abstract. He is deaf to principles and he usually tunes out any display of reasoning, especially complex reasoning. All of it strikes him as empty, useless talk. In this regard, the criminal, you can think of him as a crude materialist. A syllogism is hot air, but a machine gun is real. As a child, the criminal generally does poorly at school and finds academic subjects boring. One 12-year-old of this type objected to school as follows, quote, "Nobody wants to talk about atoms and things like that. Who likes these brainy guys?" Unquote. What the young criminal types may like at school, by contrast, is certainly not math or languages or fact-oriented or book-oriented courses, but rather images and feelings. For example, they may like what appeals, and I'm quoting from one authority, what appeals, quote, to their sense of adventure and thirst for excitement, such as a detailed account of a bloody battle or a dramatic scientific experiment, unquote. As another pre-criminal put it, quote, "I can't stand reading a book. I have to really concentrate. It's like working. I'd rather see the movie," unquote. Now, of course, this boy is right. To enter the world of concepts is work. The intellect functions only through sustained and prolonged effort. It is much easier to sit back passively and stare at a procession of pictures. I'm not sure what exactly IQ tests measure, nor whether a low intelligence is inborn or, as I suspect, at least partly self-made. Either way, however, it is instructive to note that these anti-intellectual criminal types tend to score about 10 points less on IQ tests than the average person. Most of them fall in the low normal or borderline subnormal range. That's about an IQ of between 60 and 100. The criminal mastermind is largely a fiction out of Hollywood. The unintelligent, unperceptive, mentally dull criminal is the norm. Now, you may ask, is the criminal impulsive because he's anti-intellectual? Or is it the other way around? Or is it a vicious circle? I don't know. What is important here is only that he is both. And that brings me to number three. Resentment against authority. Resentment against authority. As is inherent in his whole lifestyle, the criminal type is defiant of authority, whether it be parents, police, or society as a whole. As he sees it, there is no reason to obey the law or get an education or work for a living. Other people try to force these things on him simply because they are power lusters who want him to submit to their will, to which his reaction is no. He's not going to be a pawn or a sucker or a weakling. Only weaklings follow the system's rules. Only suckers get jobs. He intends to do what he wants to do, regardless of who stands in the way. Now observe on this instance that there is no room for reality in the criminal's mind. As he sees it, reality has nothing to say about how to act. Reality does not require work or respect for men's rights or anything else. People simply decide arbitrarily whatever they want. Life, therefore, is a clash of arbitrary desires, society's versus his own. Society, for some reason, has one kind of whim, to enslave him. He has the opposite, to follow his impulses and destroy other people first. There's no point trying to answer him by citing principles. He doesn't respect principles. Nor by citing facts about human life and its requirements. His mind is confined to the immediate perceptual data. So to any argument given by outsiders, his response is defiance. Who are you to tell me what to do? The criminal's attitude to reality is eloquently brought out by his policy of lying. As a rule, he lies so often that it becomes a character trait. In many cases, his lies are about trivial things, trivial even to him, and besides are easy to detect. In other words, the lies are often totally impractical. They are not a means to some future end, but something satisfying as an end in itself. The lying is important to him, as I, though not he, would put it, on metaphysical grounds. It is his attempt to prove that he can overcome any obstacles and get away with anything. In other words, that no recalcitrant reality stands in his path. Ordinary children, one psychiatrist observes, may lie now and then, but, quote, lying does not become a way of life. They don't experience the tremendous excitement and sense of power that the delinquent gains from lying, unquote. In this respect, his lying is a key to the criminal's entire life. It is not merely lying that gives him this tremendous excitement and sense of power, but criminality as such, and for the same reason. The criminal gets a real high when he pulls off his crime, a high out of all proportion to the loot or to the practical advantage he gains from the crime. The high, which is like the euphoria of a drug addict, is his escape from reality. In the criminal's case, it is his experience that he can do the forbidden, defy the world, smash its structures, break its laws, kill its representatives, and succeed. So there are no immutable forces in his path, no independent reality, and his will, his whim alone is efficacious. The joke here is that this defiant, perceptual level mentality, scornful of ideas and of anything so abstract as philosophy, spends his life unknowingly on struggling to attain so abstract and hopeless a goal as metaphysical power over reality. Now, today's intellectuals, I might add, are in their own way just as detached from reality as the criminal. They too define the choices in life in terms of arbitrary whims apart from reality. As they see it, the healthy man is the man who obeys society's whims, whatever they are. He is what they call socially adjusted. Whereas the essence of the criminal, they say, is he doesn't adjust to others. He is self-assertive and therefore antisocial. In this view, mental health requires conformity, and criminality implies independence. Now listen to this quote from an expert, and a right-wing expert too. The delinquent type of youth is, quote, this is the delinquent, assertive, unafraid, aggressive, unconventional, extroverted, and poorly socialized. The non-delinquents are self-controlled, concerned about their relations with others, willing to be guided by social standards, and rich in internal feelings like insecurity, helplessness, love or its lack, and anxiety. Unquote. Did you get that? The criminal is unafraid and unconventional because he acts like a vicious beast. The honest man, by contrast, is guided by social standards, not by reality, and is rich in anxiety and helplessness. One is courageous because he follows his own brutal whims. The other is nice but frightened because he follows the whims of others. Now, by these definitions, the ideal law-abiding citizen would be Peter Keating, whereas the essence of criminality, the man who is assertive, unafraid, and unconventional is Howard Rohr. Do we need to wonder why the experts cannot deal with crime? 4. amorality. On this point, the career criminal is similar to the psychopath. Morality to him is effectively non-existent. He seems to feel no guilt or remorse over his behavior, however vicious. He does not blame himself. He is oblivious to moral considerations. In the old days, he was called, without mincing words, a moral imbecile. And there are several causes underlying this attitude. Morality is a code of values, and the criminal has no values, not in the sense of enduring long-range commitments, positive or negative, around which he organizes his life. One writer refers correctly and acutely to the criminal's, quote, inner emptiness, and quotes the following, quote, apparently blocked from fulfillment at deep levels, the sociopath, that's the criminal, is not unnaturally pushed toward some sort of divertissement. Even weak impulses, petty and fleeting gratifications, are sufficient to produce in him injudicious, distasteful, and even outlandish behavior. Major positive attractions are not present to compete successfully with whims. I'm still quoting, that's his word. And the major negative deterrents, such as hot, persistent shame or profound regret, do not loom ahead to influence him, unquote. In other words, the criminal's goals and satisfactions are all perceptual level. They are short-range, concrete-bound diversions, not art or science or virtue or friendship or productive fulfillment, but gambling or sports or loot or mindless sex. That's one reason why he's amoral. But in addition, morality presupposes choice. And characteristically, the criminal type does not believe in choice or self-responsibility. In essence, he is a determinist, not by explicit statement, but by the implications of his mindless form of functioning, which makes him feel, I'm not in control. No one is. Whatever will be, will be. And of course, this idea helps him to feel blameless. Further, morality is a series of principles based on reason to guide one's life long range. In other words, it's a thoroughly conceptual subject, and thus again, he is deaf to it. And finally, morality to him, as we've seen, is purely social. It's nothing but a codification of social whims, and he's in rebellion against society. If you ask the criminal whether he can distinguish right from wrong, he will typically say, yes, but there are no absolutes, and what's true for others is not necessarily true for him, and there are exceptions to every rule, and he is the exception. And now, five of my 5-point analysis, the feeling of his own victimization. The feeling of his own victimization. Despite his dismissal of morality, the criminal has a strong sense of the evil or injustice of other people toward himself. We've already noted that the criminal sees himself as a rebel at war with society, which he sees as trying to enslave him. But now let me add the new aspect. In waging this war, the criminal is in a certain respect an intense moralist. No one can follow any course of action without some form of morality on his side to serve as defense or rationalization. So the criminal, despite his rejection of value judgments, is filled with what he sees is a justified, even righteous anger, hostility, bitterness, resentment. He not only defies others, he feels and says that he has been wronged by them, that he is a victim of a corrupt society which has mistreated, abused, and stolen from him. He feels a keen sense of what he calls his rights, which others have violated. He is not an aggressor, he feels. His life of crime is merely getting back what he is entitled to have. It is really self-defense in a vicious world. The criminal may pull jobs with a gang of Confederates, but he stays emotionally aloof from all people, even from his associates. He has no friends. His reason is clear. Others are the object of his rage. To him, they are one and all the enemy. If you try to tell the criminal that the world doesn't owe him anything, that other people earned what they have through their own honest work, so why doesn't he? His answer is no. They had luck on their side, or pull, dirty deals, dirty politics, the help of the big guys, etc. In other words, everybody is a crook, but they won't admit it. They're hypocrites as well, whereas he at least is honest about life. Do you ever hear the French socialist expression, all property is theft? Well, that names the criminal's attitude even if he doesn't read French socialist. All property is theft, and therefore he intends to get in on the act like everyone else by stealing his share from the rotten oppressors. Now, you may find it strange that the criminal so easily combines psychopathic amorality with a passionate sense of moral entitlement and of the wrongs of the world. This is a contradiction, but it is hardly unique to the criminal. Our whole culture broadcasts the same contradiction. On the one hand, we hear that morality is relative. It's a matter of convention. It's all subjective. Rigid principles are outdated. And at the same time, we hear about the absolute evil of our treatment of the poor and the minorities, and about the absolute duty the haves have to serve and save the have-nots. Now here we have decadent relativism and passionate altruism coexisting blatantly, emanating from the same cultural mouth. The criminal is simply a variant of this phenomenon. He upholds a moralism plus passionate service to him. In effect, he is the oppressed man demanding what's coming to him or else he'll seize it, as against the leftist demanding that he be given it or else the government will seize it and redistribute it to him. Either way, it's the same ethical combination and the same existential result. Now, if you want an explanation of the coexistence of amoralism and altruism, I refer you to my book, The Ominous Parallels. That is the 5 points that I've picked out as essential. If I were asked to sum up in 2 sentences, the soul they reveal, it would be, down with mind, reality, morality. Life is my whim, and woe unto anyone who gets in the way. Now, for further details about this kind of soul, I refer you to Ayn Rand's brilliant article, which I only now begin to appreciate, having done all this research, Selfishness Without a Self, which includes her psychological analysis of what she calls the tribal lone wolf. Why, in essence, a man becomes a criminal, I think, is clear. Once a man or a child rejects reason across the board, in every crucial philosophical area, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics, nothing is left to him but a life of brute force. If a man exercises force on the level of a country as a whole, he is a dictator. If he has a lesser scale of ambition, but the same kind of goal and soul, he becomes a career criminal. But now the question is, why do we have so many criminals today? Where did all these impulsive, unthinking, unprincipled, and angry young people come from? Now, note that the question is not, why is there so much crime? Crime is an action. An action implies entities. The proper question is, where did the abundance of criminals today come from? And it was not always this way. Here are some facts about the crime rate in the Western world, which I did not know, which are extremely eloquent, reported here by an authority in the field. I'm just quoting. Quote, in general, the level of crime and disorder in large cities and industrializing nations of the Western world was very high in the early decades of the 19th century, decreased substantially during the latter part of that century, and then worsened again in the mid-20th century, unquote. In other words, during the 19th century, crime began to go down substantially, and it continued to go down, or at least not rise, for many decades in the 20th century. When was the turning point? Was it the Great Depression of the 1930s? Quote, crime rates, insofar as we can tell, drifted more or less steadily downward between 1933 and the 1950s, despite the fact that the first part of this period, from 33 to 41, was characterized by a severe economic depression, and the latter part, 41 to 60, by reasonable prosperity. Crime rates then rose during the 1960s, a period of unparalleled prosperity, and continued high during the 1970s, unquote. And here's another quote. Index crime, that's the most serious crimes, rose by over 300% from 1960 to 1980, unquote, and remains persistently high to this day. So we had over a century of falling or stable crime rates, and then a massive sudden turnaround in the 1960s, when crime began to explode without let-up until it finally reached today's frightful level. Now let me cite a small but eloquent study. In 1959, some social scientists, quote, administered to a group of institutionalized male and female delinquents in Rhode Island various tests designed to measure their time orientation. In other words, were they present-oriented, short-range impulsive, or future-oriented, long-range self-control? And continuing to quote, the results showed the delinquents to be markedly more present-oriented than were comparable non-delinquents, unquote. This is what one would expect. But the study continues. 15 years later, in 1974, quote, essentially the same tests were given to a new group of institutionalized delinquents in the same state and of the same age. This group was much more present-oriented than the earlier group of delinquents. And we can infer from this, the author says, that the future orientation decayed much more rapidly for delinquents of the 1960s than for delinquents of the 1950s, unquote. In other words, the quality, the mental or philosophic quality of our juvenile delinquents declined sharply in the 15 years after 1959, just when crime was exploding. Now, are you going to explain all of these facts about the change in our crime rate and in our criminals by reference to varying levels of testosterone or serotonin in men, or to some genetic structure in short supply a century ago? That is ridiculous on its face. There is no evidence whatever of any genetic or physical factor that turned around in the 1960s after a century of waning influence. Well, our environmental change is then the explanation. For example, our industrialization, or the culture of big business, or impersonal crowded cities the cause of crime, as so many people say. Again, ridiculous. All of these things went way up in America, way up, during the very century when crime went way down. Same with immigration. Same with the ownership of handguns, which skyrocketed during the very decades when crime was dropping. A theory of crime depends on a theory of the nature of man. If man is a puppet pulled by the strings of heredity and or environment, without mind or free will, then crime must be explained in the same terms. But man is not a puppet, and that is why all the current explanations explain nothing and do not even fit the historical data. Let us try a different theory of man. Let us try the theory that man is a rational being, that he is moved not by genes or environment, but by ideas. The ideas he chooses to accept consciously or subconsciously. That is the theory of objectivism. What a man thinks is the key to his behavior. What he thinks explicitly or otherwise about the fundamental issues and values of life. That is the key, not the nonsense spouted by the experts. And that brings us to the true cause of the exploding crime rate since the 1960s. There is only one factor that did change as the crime rate did. What changed was the ideas and values which ruled America in the two periods. The ideas which dominated the low crime 19th and early 20th centuries are the opposite of the counterculture ideas which have dominated the past 3.5 high crime decades. Now let us remind ourselves first of the culture and philosophy of the low crime period. The 19th century philosophically was hardly perfect or consistent. It was a mixture of religion, altruism, and capitalistic individualism. But the contradictions had not yet taken their full toll. And out of this mixture, you can easily identify the anti-crime essentials. The schools, the churches, the popular books taught at that time the importance of study, learning, and thought. People prided themselves on living in a civilized, enlightened age. The culture taught objective thought and absolute moral principles, which no one is justified in breaking. It taught that each person has free will, and so each bears responsibility for his own behavior. The culture told a man to work hard and to pursue his own happiness. He was told he had to succeed without help, by his own effort, without welfare programs or a government grant. Sink or swim, as Horatio Alger put it. He was taught individualism, in the sense that every individual has an inalienable right to his own liberty, but that's all. And therefore, no one owes him a living. Now, how did all this affect the training of the young? Quote, in the mid-19th century, child-rearing advice emphasized the importance of inculcating moral and religious principles so as to make the child at an early age a self-maintaining moral being. Continuing the quote, in 1890, 1900, and 1910, one-third of the child-rearing topics discussed in a sample of articles from Ladies' Home Journal, Woman's Home Companion, and Good Housekeeping were about character development. In 1920, only 3% were. By 1930, articles on character development had by and large been replaced with ones on personality development. In other words, I interject, morality was being replaced with self-expression. And continuing the quote, whereas the magazines in 1890 had said that character was best developed by providing a good home influence, by 1920, the route to a well-adjusted personality was thought chiefly to involve proper feeding, unquote. Here's another quote. In the 19th century, scarcely anyone dissented from the view that character formation required teaching people to restrain self-indulgent impulses. By the 1920s, popular versions of the theories of Sigmund Freud had led many persons to believe that adult problems arose because children and adolescents had been taught to repress their instincts, unquote. Now, as I trust you in this audience know, it is not merely Freud who is to blame for the 20th century, but the whole trend of modern philosophy from Kant to pragmatism. But the key point is, in a culture like that of the 19th century, it is no wonder that world wars vanished and that the crime rate dropped sharply. The public and the youth were being taught and immersed in the exact opposite of all the war-generating and criminality-generating traits. The result was one of the most peaceful and civilized centuries in history. Now let's turn to the current scene. It took many generations and gradual steps before the Kantian intellectuals conquered America. For details, I refer again to my book, The Ominous Parallel. The moderns did not take over the schools completely until the 1930s, when John Dewey was finally institutionalized. And it required another generation after this until the children brought up on progressive education became parents themselves. Now, at last, we had schools, parents, culture all aligned. And among them, they raised the first purely modern, in other words, Kantian pragmatist generation. The new youth appeared on the scene on schedule in the 1960s. Between them and their children, America's culture was reversed. The vestiges of the 19th century in every aspect and area gave way to the counterculture. The better people today, who are in the great majority, still have enough common sense and moral character left to survive the corrupt ideas being pounded into them. But the weaker types, who are being turned out by the system in ever greater numbers, are succumbing to it. They absorb what they hear at home, in school, in church, in the movies and comic books, on the streets, without even knowing what they are accepting. And many of them, far too many, then move naturally into a life of crime. What is it they and all of us hear today? In essence, a sustained anti-conceptual, anti-reality torrent in the form of all the modern bromides. There is no certainty, there are no facts. Everything is a matter of opinion. Everything is constantly changing. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? Words are a matter of semantics. There are no absolutes. Express yourself whatever yourself is. Act on your impulse. The cold hand of reason kills. Only the mystic Orient or Nancy Reagan's astrologer or Bill Clinton's guru knows the answers. In other words, thinking is useless. Reality is unknowable by reason, be guided instead by your blood, your race, your feelings, your peers, or your leaders. Likewise, morality, we hear, is impossible. Who knows what's right or wrong? Everything is relative. Life is compromised. Plus, we're all products of forces, heredity, or environment outside of our control. There is no free will or individual responsibility. Individualism and independence are outdated. The group is more important than the individual. The essence of life is not the pursuit of selfish happiness, but service and sacrifice. Now, the idea of sacrifice as noble entrenches and blesses the whole criminal mentality. If you teach sacrifice as morality, you are saying that a clash among men is unavoidable, that independence is impossible, that some men must be sacrificed for others, and it is merely a question of who should make the sacrifices and who should profit from them. Should you be the victim and others the beneficiary, or vice versa? If that is the choice in life which you broadcast to the youth, it is an open invitation to the budding criminal to start sacrificing others before they sacrifice him. After all, as the criminal sees it, remember point five, he is a victim. Others have been sacrificing him to their own interests for years. So now, by society's own statement of the options, it must be his turn. Now, the doctrine of self-sacrifice was commonly preached in the 19th century, but it was blurred and moderated by the legacy of the 18th, which upheld individual rights, private profit, and the pursuit of one's own happiness. Today, the doctrine is no longer moderated. Since the 60s, it has been preached loudly and with total consistency for the first time in history. And I mean here the extreme, consistent version of altruism, egalitarianism. If everyone is supposed to be equal, equal in all goods, services, and values, without earning anything, without achieving anything, simply as a right inherent from birth, then every inequality, no matter what its cause, is by definition an injustice. Every inequality becomes a cry to the have-nots, which means to whoever don't have something, anything that they want. It becomes a cry to the have-nots that they have been demeaned, persecuted, exploited, or robbed of their birthright. Every inequality of income, prestige, influence, you name it, is a proof that the person who has less is a victim. And that society, which is not showering values on him, even though it preaches his right to equality, is a lying hypocrite. Can you think of a better way to inculcate in whole generations the feelings of hostility, bitterness, and resentment? Can you think of a better way of creating a society in which mobs of people seethe with anger at the injustices they are forced to suffer? You couldn't think of a better way. Today, our intellectuals and politicians broadcast on all channels the message that society has reneged on its duty to the blacks, the poor, the females, the gays. So all these groups deserve apologies, sacrifices, and large-scale reparations. Every group, sect, or gang in the country deserves it, we hear, except straight white males, the arch-victimizers. Is it possible to preach such doctrines and leave people unaffected? How can our teachers sow the seeds of unreason and group hatred so thoroughly, yet not reap the whirlwind? How can they claim to be aghast at crime while egging the future criminals on morally from preschool on up? In other words, while instilling in them all the ideas and emotions that lead to crime. The last three decades have been philosophically perfect by the standard of creating criminals. What marvelous rationalizations these decades have offered to the would-be criminal. All the basic ideas of the criminal mind, every one of them, has now become the official dogma of the intellectuals and of the culture they spawn. Who then can be surprised at the explosion of crime? Crime is not caused by poverty, by youth, or by discrimination. Otherwise, we'd have 1,000 times more crime. The great bulk of the poor, the young, and the ethnics, like decent Americans everywhere, are repelled and outraged by criminal behavior. But the weaker members of these groups, who in the 19th century would have been ashamed of and tended to squelch any budding criminal tendencies, are now indoctrinated with all the ideas that nurture and actualize their worst potential. Crime comes from a view of the world and a set of values. It is a result of the criminal's distinctive ideas, which he shares with criminals from all sorts of different backgrounds, ages, and countries. Our establishmentarians who preach those ideas are inconsistent enough to preserve a semi-civilized veneer which comes from a long undermined code of decency. The criminals merely dispense with this veneer. In that respect, they are, if you will, more honest. Now, I do not mean to imply that criminals are helpless pawns of a corrupt society. They, too, have free will. In their very early years, they chose repeatedly to place whims above reality, a choice which a small and potentially criminal minority in every era makes. And then the future criminals chose a life pattern of whim worship, justified by today's worst ideas. And then they sustained that pattern in action by further continuous choice and evasion. For all this, they are guilty, and they do deserve punishment. But even more profoundly, the guilt belongs to those who offered them ready-made the corrupt ideas they needed. The deepest responsibility is not that of the thugs who chose to run wild in the temple of our skyscrapers, but of the professors who broke open the doors for them. What is the solution? To uproot from our schools and universities the ideas of the criminal mind and replace them with something better. That will not stop the budding criminals from forming, but it would certainly keep plenty of these buds from ever blooming. A return to Victorianism, however, will not work, precisely because the 19th century was built in part on religion and on altruism. It could not sustain a civilized philosophy. That's why it was ripe to be subverted by the rebelling conscience. No, we need to replace criminal ideas by their exact opposites, by the opposites of our 5 points. And reducing a volume to a few sentences, that would mean we need to teach our youth to be long range, in other words, to act on reason as against impulse, to function on the conceptual level, in other words, to be principled, to be intellectually active, to follow and admire the mind, to be reality oriented as against being conformist or whim worshiping, to be moral absolutists. And finally, to recognize that morality entails ambition, independence, and work, not any kind of rage for an effortless equality. We need to teach that each man should live by his own mind and effort and for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others nor others to himself. I hope that sounds familiar to you. In other words, we need to teach a philosophy of reality and of reason, which stresses the conceptual level of consciousness, and also an absolute morality of rational self-interest. Only these ideas will wipe out the foundation for a culture of crime. Now, I trust you see that I am honestly not here merely propagandizing for objectivism, which alone teaches all these ideas. I am reading off from the essence of criminality what its counteracting essence would have to be. So if the question is what to do about crime, which is my official title, I would say teach a rational philosophy. That is the only fundamental intellectual answer that I can give. Now, by contrast, let us look at the two dominant answers given today to the problem of crime. The liberals preach prevention as more important than punishment, which is valid as far as it goes. If you can prevent crime from happening, that is certainly better than merely punishing the perpetrator after the damage is done. But how will we prevent crime? The liberal answer is through the welfare state, through an array of governmental programs that allegedly pacify, nurture, and reorient the downtrodden. This solution has been tried for many decades now. Not only has it not made a dent in the crime problem, it has in fact continually worsened the problem. Since the essence of criminality is dependence, preying on others to survive, it is impossible to reduce crime by increasing dependence, which is precisely what government programs do. Forcible redistribution of income, the essence of the welfare state, happens to be the essence of crime too, at least as far as property is concerned. The government must set an honest example to the would-be criminal, not outdo him in theft. If we want the criminal to be self-responsible, we must leave him alone to face fully the absolute which all men face. Work to support yourself or starve. And this means an end to the welfare state measures of the last 60-plus years. It means a laissez-faire capitalist society in which independent work is the only means of survival. Now, the other liberal remedy is rehabilitation of the criminal in jail. And again, I agree. It's much better to rehabilitate a man and gain a moral citizen than merely to lock him up forever and have to support him for life, or release him and turn him loose again on an unsuspecting populace. But what the liberals have in mind specifically as rehabilitation are schooling when he's in jail or psychotherapy. Both of these are useless as rehabilitation, as they have in fact proved to be when tried out. No one is being rehabilitated today. The recidivism rates attest to that. Schooling, at best, merely produces educated criminals. But they still place that schooling in the service of their untouched criminal mind. Psychotherapy, as practiced today, merely produces criminals with plenty of rationalizations to blame others, and thus to excuse and justify their own behavior. Since criminality is at root a way of thinking about life, only a form of therapy which changes the characteristic thinking methods of the criminal will or can work. And this kind of therapy, I may say, has actually been discovered and tried out, and not by an objectivist either. And although ignored by liberals and conservatives alike, it seems actually to work. For an excellent description, I refer you to a book entitled Inside the Criminal Mind by Stanton E. Samenow, S-A-M-E-N-O-W, especially chapter 13, which I thought a revelation. That chapter is called To Change a Criminal. Now, Dr. Samenow's method, however, will never be accepted by today's experts because it requires and presupposes a rational philosophic foundation. But the blueprint is there if rehabilitation is of interest to you. As to the conservative solution to the problem of crime, it is worse than the liberals. The conservatives throw up their hands in despair and do not even consider the causes or prevention of crime. Their answer is merely lock them up and throw away the key. Now, the conservatives, let me say, are right that the criminal justice system today is a disgrace. The O.J. trial is enough to prove that conclusively. And the conservatives are right that we will never reduce crime without establishing and enforcing a system of swift, certain, and severe punishment for offenders. But this is not enough. There is no sense whatever in methodically breeding criminals by the essence of our culture's basic philosophy, to which conservatives contribute fully as much as liberals, and then trying to round up and incarcerate the debased human products which result. Nor will we ever get a proper criminal justice system without a fundamental change in our society's ideas. The conservative approach, being anti-intellectual, is hopeless. Nor will it be improved by prayer in the schools or by mindless penal formulas taken from athletics. The solution to the problem of crime is not midnight basketball, and it is not three strikes and you're out. The solution is not midnight basketball, but daytime philosophy. And if there's to be any baseball analogy, it should be addressed not to the criminals, but to the college professors behind them who built our crime-friendly culture. We should say to those creators of corruption, three irrationalities and you're out of work. That is the ultimate solution to the problem of crime. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dr. Peacock, 3 years ago you urged us here to vote for Bill Clinton in part because you hoped it would re-energize a Republican opposition. Your plan seems to have worked better than I had thought. So what do you think of the new Republican majority, its contract with America, and especially the contract's provisions on crime?
Well, let me say thank you for that question, because it is very difficult for philosophers who deal generally only with very broad abstractions to come to reality and actually connect to it. And I am very proud to say that I called the results of that election perfectly. I'm bragging about that because I don't have a lifetime record of having done that. So I'm basking in the glory of having predicted exactly what would happen. And I'm delighted. The whole country voted the same way I did for the same reason. And it had exactly the effect on the Republicans, more than you could hope for. So to that extent, I'm happy. The Republicans, I have to say before I go into denunciation, have a certain courage. They have certainly come on for them as strong basically as they can. I would never have predicted when I talked about, you know, an energized Republican Party that they would do anything, that they would even have measures to pass. You know, I thought they would just talk a little better, but that they actually come up with, you know, some really decent measures is amazing to me after a lifetime contempt for Republicans. You know, I have had the experience several times. I've been saying the same thing for decades. And, you know, for decades, people would think, this is a weirdo and these ideas are inconceivable. And now people say, are you a Republican? To the same, you know, ideas. So I have to give them credit. Having said that, I think that the hearts of the Republicans are much better off than their heads. And they haven't been very religious in their public statements. There were a few preliminary signs that they were going to get religious. And they took some polls, and they quickly put that in the backseat. And up to this point, they haven't done anything about that, so I give them credit for that. But you can only go so far without any philosophy. And the problem is that they hold the standard philosophy, and so there's a limit to what they can do. All they can realistically do is cut back on some bits of the welfare state, which to some extent they're doing. From that point of view, I give them credit. It takes a certain courage to attack welfare and school lunches and the public TV, etc. But the thing that really blows me up and makes me think that it's futile, having said all these kind words, is there are only two measures on which the welfare state depends and on which the country's bankruptcy is guaranteed, and that is Social Security and Medicare. If you had to reduce, to cut anything in this whole world, that's the place that you'd have to make the start that would blow up the welfare state and turn things around. So the first thing they say is Social Security is off the table, and Medicare they're going to reduce by means of turning it into the whole country into the equivalent of an HMO, a managed care, which is meant to eviscerate and destroy what's left of medical care. Now, that's two gigantic mistakes, if you're kind enough to call that a mistake. The result of that is that I do not hold out a great hope. I think the Republic has made a big mistake by starting on welfare mothers and children. They should have divided the country up into all the segments that feed at the public trough, because it is not just welfare mothers as bad as they are. It's big businessmen who get tremendous subsidies and protective tariffs, and it's farmers who get parity prices and labor legislation that's an incredible benefit to the unions, etc. And they should have taken every single group, and the elderly who are more recipient of money than any single other group and have the most powerful lobby in the country. They should have taken every single one of these and said something like 20% off this year, and another 20% in 3 years, and another 20%, and weaned everybody at the same time. It's completely unfair to take, you know, the people on the bottom, who I grant you shouldn't be on welfare, and raise a big moral fuss about them while the people on the take, in as worse ways, are completely exempt. And from that point of view, they're simply opening themselves to the charge that they're paying off their campaign contributors and they're unprincipled. And I can't predict a healthy or happy future as a result of them. Now, as to what they're doing with regard to crime, it's this thing about more police is great, but you know, it comes back to let's have less criminals, but you know, that would mean having proper educational system in this country. You would not do it by altering. There's no crime bill in Washington is going to cut back on crime.
Thank you.
Dr. Peacock, what comment would you have about the recent bombing in Oklahoma, and specifically about the philosophies of those suspected of being responsible?
I think the recent bombing in Oklahoma was a national tragedy. It's almost inconceivable, if you see the pictures of that building in Oklahoma and you see the people interviewed, the survivors and the families that remain, that this happened in the heartland of the United States. And according to the current information, which is sketchy and probably will be filled out substantially, it was a group of right-wing, that's what they call them, paramilitary freaks that have a grudge against the federal government for a whole combination of reasons, ranging from allegedly their opposition to income tax. But the thing that I hear that they are most upset about and why they picked that date is that it was the anniversary of the FBI putting an end to that Waco cult 2 years ago in Texas. And they consider that an outrageous act on the part of the government. I want to tell you that I'm even thinking of writing an op-ed piece on this. Those people are the ones that did this bombing, and those from which they come, in my view, are the essence of evil. I don't like to keep recommending my book. They are out of the ominous parallels. They are the perfect example of true Nazism arising in this country. Observe that. They're supposedly right-wing, but obviously they're not individualists. They have no concept of individual rights because they have no concept of an individual. They just simply threw a bomb, or exploded a bomb, utterly oblivious to whether it's going to be babies, elderly, uninvolved people, what this is going to do to real individual human lives. They're completely blind to that. They see only our gang and their gang. Us and them, that's the total mentality. That is a thorough collectivist as you can get. Like a Communist Party member could not be more collectivist than that. In addition to that, it's a special kind of collectivism. They are doing it in the name of the nation, America. Now, America to them is not the country of the Constitution, because that's individualism and individual rights. So America is to them just simply the mystic national entity in which we live, and we are going to bomb what's going on in defense of this mystic entity. That's called nationalism. And a collectivist nationalism is another name for, nationalism is a form of collectivism. That is exactly what Hitler was. And that is exactly what these people are on many other counts in addition. It's instructive to me that they have their own military formations, which, by the way, should be entirely illegal in this country. No one, no matter what your view is on gun ownership, should be able to defend the idea that you are allowed to start your own army. There is nothing whatever in the Second Amendment or in the right to own a gun. There's nothing in the issue of personal self-defense or a hobby or target practice or animal shooting that would justify you in having an arsenal such as they had in Waco or a military formation. When it gets to the point that citizens have their own armies and arsenals, that is the end of a free country. That's exactly what happened in the Weimar Republic. Every party and group had their own armies, and you happen to know which ones became most famous. It was the SA and the SS started as paramilitary formations in the Weimar Republic. Now, why these people aren't arrested, one and all, for this? I've also heard the FBI say that they're not allowed to infiltrate these paramilitary organizations until they commit a crime. I think it should be a crime to start these formations. That is an objective recourse to physical force, which any rational person has to take as a threat to the possibility of existing in peace. They should be infiltrated from top to bottom. We should know every one of their names. The weapons should be confiscated, and they should be treated as killers, which is what they are. That is such a parallel to exactly what happened in the case of Hitler. Notice also that they don't make any bones about having any reasonable case for this. They admire this Koresh outfit. They call it a church. They are complete, admirers of cultists. And that would be clear. Anybody who throws a bomb is not somebody who reads or thinks. And on top of that, just the cherry on the cake, if anybody had any doubts about this, one of their crusades is apparently that a white supremacist was hung on legal grounds for having killed a Jew and a black, and that's one of the causes which their literature is defending the evil of the so-called evil of the government. Now, what is a racist, irrationalist nationalism that appeals to military formation and weaponry, if that is a Nazism? I didn't say fascism, but Nazism. That is out of Hitler's Germany. And why did it happen here? There's a, read the ominous parallels. I predicted it in 1982. But the moral, I just have to say, I know I'm speaking at too great length, but just one sentence. The moral is not what I've heard several commentators say, well, that shows you where extremism gets you. That shows you where the premises of collectivism and irrationalism get you. And in that, the only alternative is extreme rationality and extreme individualism. If you're extreme on the right premises, that's the only antidote. But of course, they're going to draw the conclusion that anybody who's an extremist is a maniac, and therefore only pragmatism will save us. Let them try to figure out where their pragmatism, how they got to where they are right now. That's a start on what I have to say.
One of the other quote-unquote causes of crime that's been discussed a lot by conservatives is the decline in quote-unquote family values and the rise of illegitimacy, both of which have sort of coincided also with the rise in crime. Are these philosophically, if not causally, related to the rise in crime?
No, I don't think that broken homes or illegitimacy per se contributes to crime. What it's obviously connected with is what kind of intellectual or moral upbringing do these people get? And if it was simply the case that two people got married had a child and did not get married, but otherwise brought up the child appropriately, there would be no no jot more likelihood that he would grow up a criminal. But what happens in these cases is because of the welfare situation and the regulations, the father takes off, the mother is uninterested in work, the kid grows up in the streets, he gets the lowest public schooling, he lives in drug-infested areas thanks to the fact that the government has given the mafia control over drugs by refusing to make it legal. In other words, the kid is brought up in every possible circumstance that will, if he isn't a genius or a strongly independent person, turn him into a weakling who will go along with whatever is put to him. And it's not the illegitimacy per se that does that. It's the fact that he has no guidance, whatever. And what makes it even worse is every time he turns the TV on, there is some liberal commentator announcing that this is an outrage. He deserves to have society look after him, and that he's being deprived of his rightful just deserts. Well, no wonder. Plus the fact that with the economy as rigidified as it is by controls, it's become prohibitive today to employ even a qualified worker, because you don't only have to employ him, you have to give him medication and a rest home for the rest of his life. Even qualified people find it tough getting a job with minimum wage laws and all the rest. Go and try, which is your hope of, if you have no training, is to take a job at a very low rate and be trained and acquire the habits of the market. You can't do that anymore. Those by the fact that the government that requires the employer to be your mother, father, and mother-in-law for life, no one can get a job from these people. So they're put in an impossible position. They're closed off totally, and then they're told they're victims. Now go and figure out from that why they become crimes. It's not illegitimacy. That's just one of the factors that contribute to the total corruption of ideas that stuff down their heads. And even there, the great majority are honest, and they're in an impossible position.
Since, as you've said, crime is a result of a philosophy, and you also indicated that children seem to show traits that will lead to criminality very early, I found it interesting. Does that seem to imply that children have acquired some very abstract philosophic ideas by the age of 4 or 8? And could you comment on any educational consequences of that fact?
Well, children certainly have the equivalent of ideas, but only implicitly. They are not completely tabula rasa until they turn 18 and go to take philosophy in school. A human being by his nature generalizes and can't avoid doing so. And as soon as a child acquires a vocabulary and is able to speak implicitly, if not explicitly, he is generalizing. And I think, to simplify a very complex subject, that the root of crime is volitional, and I tried to suggest what I thought it was. You have a continuous choice from as soon as you're able to exercise the faculty of choice, which I think is in the very early years, before 4, whether you're going to focus on the facts or whether you're going to say, I want it, or I'm afraid of it, or take some emotion that you feel which clashes with the fact and follow it. And I think implicitly, if you do that once or twice, but most of the time you follow reason, that's one thing. But if a number of times you do it and you get away with it, you implicitly generalize that this is your way of functioning. And there are children who are very upset at the age of 5 and 6, which I have seen, thankfully not my own. But they're upset at 5 and 6 and not getting their way, and they have tantrums, and it's not, believe it or not, because they want so much the concrete thing that they're being denied. It's a matter of principle. Their whole metaphysics and way of life is threatened by the fact that if they're not given into, then they're going to have to change their whole personality, which is in their minds already set at 6. Now, I don't say it has to be that way, but there's no doubt that an implicit view of life is inherent in children from the time they can speak. It's not fixed, however. It's open. I don't say to change by others because a child has free will. But it's open, you know, to persuasion up to whichever point, in whatever terms the child can understand, and especially to the parent giving a clear-cut existential response that there's going to be a punishment of so-and-so and an explanation as to why. As to the educational results, anybody who starts off on this path will not develop educationally well at all, because he'll become anti-intellectual for the reasons I said. He'll be bored by reading. Another thing, therefore, I strongly suggest, if you have young children, do not let them watch too much TV or play too many video games. I restrict my daughter to 1 hour of visual entertainment a day. That's it. That includes, video games, TV, computers, whatever you look at on a screen, which is pictures, because I think that is very harmful to the development of the conceptual faculty. That's controversial. That is not objectivism, by the way, and Ayn Rand never told me that. That is my own, but it's definitely my own view. I regard TV as the enemy, not from the point of view of the content, but the danger of just sitting there passively before pictures. You know, when we grew up, there were no such things. There was no computers, video games, or TV. We could see a movie once a week. And that, you know, that didn't hurt. But, anyway.
Dr. Peacock, good evening. I'd like to just make a few comments. I don't really have a question, but I would like to just suggest something. First, that your answers really... for the most part, from my point of view, are no answers at all to what the problems are in this country. First off, you said that prayer in the school wasn't an answer, and I'd like to call your attention to a book called America, to Pray or Not to Pray, which was a statistical analysis of a question asked of educators by the Gallup organization, which, as you know, is not a religious organization. Their question was, what do you feel are the 10 worst offenses committed in the classroom today? And this was aimed at educators. At that time, they said running in the hall, throwing spitballs, talking class, and so on. The same group of people, educators, in the 1980s were again surveyed by the Gallup organization, and they were asked that same question. The answer was murder, rape, arson, assault of the teacher, etc., to be brief.
Could you connect that into prayer?
Yeah. First, I'd like to say that if you look at the case in New York, it was a 22-word prayer, which simply said, paraphrasing, Almighty God, I pray that you will protect my fellow students, my teachers, my family, and my country. This book did a statistical analysis of those categories and found that when prayer in the school was taken away, if you looked at the charts in the book, and it's full of charts, it's like we went off into a chasm. So the answer, I think, first relies there. If you have 3 million students praying to a creator above, they'll be fearful of, which, of course, we should be fearful but loving as well.
Sir,
let's stop.
Excuse me.
Well, I think we have too many people who need to ask questions of Dr. Peacock. If he could respond to your first point, and then... Well, if you could let these others, and then perhaps if we have time, please. All right.
Answer again. Secondly, I think that the answer in the whole life spectrum is from the womb to the tomb, you have to protect all human life. If we're not really willing to defend life, whether it be the unborn child or the elderly person, the Dr. Kevorkians of the world will become like more vultures in this world, and the United States will then collapse. That's what's happening now, is a disintegration. And I just suggest to you that those are more the relevant answers than what some of what you gave
us. Okay, I think I get the message. thank you for your suggestions. I have a choice of answering at length or briefly. I'm going to answer briefly. First of all, that poll that you suggested, I read recently. In fact, I heard on TV, was made up by somebody in Texas, and they actually traced it back. Who is that brave reporter on ABC who comes on? Stossel, yeah. So if you check with ABC, they have eviscerated that poll. But leaving that aside, I deny any statistics that the presence or absence of prayer in the school affects the behavior of the children. Any statistics, because a prayer would have to be literally magic, and I don't believe in magic on metaphysical grounds. If you say, Almighty God, please protect us all, that is not going to have any effect whatever on the criminal mind as I already described it. All it's going to do at most is weaken his sense of reality even further. Because if there is... if there is an all-powerful God who can intercede and change the course of nature in answer to our wishes or our prayers, we then are one step removed from having omnipotence. All we have to do is ally ourselves with God, and he will pull the strings, and reality becomes fluid and non-absolute again. As the last thing I would want a child to know if I'm trying to teach him the absolutism of reality or morality, to tell him, yeah, but there's a super bureaucrat of the universe who can pull strings and make things pass. In addition, I object altogether to the idea that the way to avoid crime is to instill fear of anything. Fear is not a proper motivation, whether it's of God or of jail, as far as that's concerned. You have got to instill self-esteem and self-confidence of the person in his ability to deal with reality and achieve long-range goals. And any attempt to inject morality by making him afraid of some authority, God or society, is simply weakening his ability to follow morality, because he's now becoming an uncertain, self-doubtful type of individual, and his whole foundation for the strength and the courage that's required to live morally is undercut at the root. As for your last, I mean, any one of these, you know, we could have a whole class on, but as to your last remark about we have to protect all human life, that altogether depends on what you mean by human life. I would say we have to protect all innocent human life. And I would put those two words with a definite meaning. Human presupposes that it's an entity, not a growth inside a woman. An actual entity, not merely the potential of becoming an entity. And even if it is a fully formed entity, it has no rights and deserves no protection once it violates the human means of survival. Once it behaves like a beast by physical force, like a lion in a jungle, and commits murder or bombs, which is worse than any animal could imagine, you are morally obligated to take away that person's rights. He has no rights any further. And if you can show that he did it, to take away his life in addition. So you cannot say, let's protect human life, because you have a choice of protecting the life of the victim or the life of the killer. You cannot protect both. And I say, given that choice, protect the innocent and kill the killers. That's it. That's it. Yeah, you've had it. Jeffrey, let's go on. Let's get somebody else.
As a follow-up to a question that was asked previous, I was wondering if when it may be too late for a child or an adult, just as it may be too late for a modern philosopher to change his view of life, for him to change his way of living, the criminal, that is.
Oh, well, according to this book, I brought it just so you can see it. And this, I'm doing publicity for this guy because I never met him. But according to him, he can take criminals in their 30s, 40s, and 50s and rehabilitate them, and has done so, you know, not with 100% success, but with surprising success. So I would never... A human being has free will. Now, that doesn't mean that it's just as easy to become good when you're corrupt in your 50s as when you're relatively, you know, benign and you're 10. But I think it's possible in many cases. I would never list an age. It's so long as the person is willing to try and has some guidance, I think there is hope. But the people for whom there's no hope are the ones at any age that, either because they've accepted an idea or they've just given a certain emotion, absolutism in their mind, but they have basically said, I am unchangeable. I am unreachable. And I think the criminal type becomes that very young. And the only way that Dr. Samino says is you have to get them at a moment when they've been arrested, they're facing a long term, and you can get them where they themselves feel a despair. My life is wrecked. I'm not getting away with it. You know, I'm a total failure. And then he says he does the exact opposite of what the conventional therapists do. You know, especially in California where you pay everybody to have self-esteem. But the typical psychotherapist comes in and says, don't be so upset by your crime. You're a wonderful person. You know, it was just your mother was so cruel to you and so on. And allegedly they're going to give him self-esteem and solve his problems. Now, of course, Dad doesn't give him any self-esteem. It just lets him off the hook. But what Dr. Samino suggested is you come in and tell the guy what a swine you are. What a horrible life you've lived. What a you know, utterly worthless, depraved piece of scum you are. And when he sees that, say to him, you know, you can change, but in order to change, you've got a tremendous job ahead of you. And you have to earn self-esteem. And he outlines the whole program, and these people come every day. The assignment is to, he's got like 10 or 15 types of thought that are indications of criminal activity. Every day they have to account for their thoughts of the preceding 24 hours. And every one of these little temptations that come up, they go over, they discuss, they analyze. And it's a really a fascinating excursion. Anybody at any age who would have someone who would guide him and who would be willing to try, I hold out hope for. The ones with least hope, and I'm not saying this sarcastically, is intellectuals with PhDs. Because they have such a disgusting view of ideas as just being a con game of the intellect that the problem would be to get them to listen to an idea. A criminal in that sense is more innocent. You know, he still has enough capacity to grasp one idea versus another. Whereas the advocates of contemporary ideas have passed that point. They've insulated themselves from ideas. But I would never take a child and say 14 is too late. I mean, any age, some of them are gone at 3.
I'm kind of nervous about this question, but I was edified when you drew the distinction again between the potential and the actual. I'll slow down too.
Yeah.
Doesn't forbidding an action or banning an organization based on a potential threat rather than an actual, specific, concrete action violating rights constitute positive law, which objectivism, to my knowledge, does not uphold? Preemptive law.
You got me. Preemptive? Say it again.
Isn't banning an organization or forbidding an action... Banning an organization, such as a militia,
Am I not then acting against them before they've proven that they're a threat? Well, the question becomes, what do you take as proof that something is a threat? A threat does not have to mean carrying out the actual crime. It doesn't even have to mean the first step toward actually carrying it out. It has to mean taking a step which objectively there is no rational explanation for other than the assumption that a crime is going to be committed. Now, for example, suppose somebody collected all of the materials necessary for an atomic bomb, all of them, in his backyard. And he's sitting there, and he's perfectly peaceful, and he's a nice guy, and he kids around with you over the fence. And meanwhile, he's screwing the various parts together, and he's reading the blueprint and so on. Would you say, well, all he's doing is manufacturing the bomb. Wait till he, you know, ignites it. That's bizarre. There are things which you cannot begin to do when you, you know, if he bought out the state of Nevada and he, you know, he had fallout radioactive insurance, etc., and he could keep it in, he wants to blow it up, that's one thing. But you cannot do that sort of thing and live in a civilized society. And there are lawyers should be spending the time precisely making the distinction between what is safe, what is an objective threat, etc., instead of spending the time on how they can screw up the evidence and let obviously guilty people off. Not to mention any names.
I'm going to have to limit it to one question more from each aisle, please.
I just want to say your remarks are funny, enlightening, and stimulating, but I'd like you to respond to what I perceive as a major flaw in some of your analysis, going back to your equation with low crime rates and teaching of sort of objective criteria for promoting reason and rationality and things that you would probably equate with objectivism. You sort of implied that the phenomenon of relatively low crime rates in the midst of the Depression was directly equatable to these objective standards that were taught in the schools, and I agree with you, and I think that's a very, very important point to be made. But what I perceived as a sort of a conservative bias of your, what I would call hyper-libertarianism, and which unfortunately characterizes libertarianism generally, which I think is a very important third way, could be a third way in this country and in world philosophy, is an unfortunate attribute, because you overlooked what essentially held crime down aside from, parallel to these objective standards that everybody shared in those days, including the socialists. And the ideas of the New Deal were essentially what kept these gangs of workers from storming Washington, because these programs that were implemented by the federal government, why someone like Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, was because he offered an alternative, a very highly principled, rational alternative to what was perceived as a laissez-faire perspective. And in those days, people who were socialists had just as much highly structured, rational, objective criteria. We may not have agreed with them, but it was not a question of political perspective, but that everybody in those days shared a rational, intellectual approach to things. So I would just wondered if you could comment on those differences.
First of all, I would not want to be regarded as a libertarian. I am not a libertarian. I regard libertarianism as a thorough corruption. That's a subject for another discussion. I just want to dissociate myself entirely from that term. I'm an objectivist. We believe strongly in government and in the desirability of government, so long as that government is acting as an agent to protect the innocent and the rights of the innocent from being violated by physical force or fraud. Let's get rid of libertarianism as a term. And your example of government being used to put down crime, to prevent crime, was the New Deal, which prevented workers from storming Washington. I'll go by one step before that and say, why did things get so bad that we had a depression in which the workers would have stormed Washington? Now, the pro-capitalist explanation, which I subscribe to, and here I have to recommend that you read Ludwig von Mises or somebody other than Karl Marx, is that the depression...
I've read Ludwig von Mises,
is that the depression was caused by government intervention in the economy, specifically by the Federal Reserve's manipulation of credit rates, keeping interest down too low, allowing a boom to go on that never would have gone on in a free country. That the entire collapse in the 30s was a consequence of government intervention in the economy, and that if we had had free banking and not had all of these structures put in place since the Progressive Era, we would never have had this to begin with. So I don't take your example as proving anything. Moreover, the kind of crime I'm talking about, which is hardened career-type criminals, presumably you do not believe that the people who stormed or would storm Washington when out of a job come in that category. I wouldn't. Anybody could be in despair against any particular government. That doesn't come under crime. So you're reaching, you know, under the table to get some example of popular discontent. I'll give you this much, the New Deal period. If I had to put President Roosevelt, as bad an opinion of him as I have, next to President Clinton, and just have each of them articulate five sentences, I would certainly vote for Roosevelt if that was a choice on the grounds of proximity to humanity. In other words, people at that time were still educated. They had a certain decorum. They had an ability to articulate three sentences and form, you know, a plan, etc. They were still from the pre-progressive era, and to that extent, it was better. And I think that's part of the reason why crime continued to drop. Unfortunately, President Roosevelt gave a mortal blow to this country by destroying the American system. He and his cousin, you know, the other Roosevelt, were the two worst presidents ever in terms of their policies, the two that destroyed capitalism in this country. And if you understand my remarks, you know, I understand our debate is political. It's not over the cause of crime. We'd have to do that another time. But if you understand anything as to why I believe that authoritarian or paternalistic government inculcates crime, on that premise, you see that the two Roosevelts are the two worst. But we'd have to make that another...
Yeah, but you just have to not equate socialism with the Federal Reserve Bank. That's
utterly ridiculous. I think that is a step toward socialism. Just like I don't equate these gangs with full-fledged Hitler, these paramilitary hoodlums, but as a step toward it. It's the same analogy. Thank you very much.